residents believe they will return because the Jenin camp has always been a symbol of steadfastness.
Despite calculated attempts of the occupying regime to eliminate the Palestinian people through raids, land confiscation, and settlement expansion, Palestinians stand firm today.
We lived through the first and second intifadas, facing raids, demolitions, and tanks, but we always stood our ground. But this invasion has been the hardest. We were forced out of our homes and became displaced in our own land, leaving behind a camp where every corner holds memory. Still, we remain patient and steadfast. The Jenin camp isn't just a place for us, it is our life.
I am a refugee, and today, once again, I am displaced. I lived through raids, fear, and long sieges, and we always stayed strong. But being forced out of the camp this time is different. We left behind everything we built, and the place where we raised our children is no longer there.
It is not a conflict. It is the occupation of Palestine. From an outside entity solely created by the West, Palestinians are being killed. Their homes are demolished and being displaced every day. What is happening in the West Bank today is part of a calculated effort to weaken, fragment, and erase the Palestinian people and their personal, culture, and historical identity.
The first Palestinian Intifada, a defining moment 37 years ago, remains a powerful symbol of Palestinian resistance. And today, as Israeli escalation intensifies in Jenin, that same spirit continues to shape the people's determination to withstand the ongoing campaign of violence. Tiba Asi, Occupy Jenin.
Iran's northeastern province of Golestan, once primarily known for agriculture and forestry, is emerging as a major hub for the country's fishing and aquaculture industry, thanks to recent investments in modern fisheries practices, including growth in caviar production.
The province's climate and abundant water resources make fisheries a core development sector for us. We have some of the most diverse aquaculture in the country, producing over 30,000 tons of fish, including caviar and shrimp. This capacity also positions us well to attract both local and international investors.
A key component of the province's fisheries is the Iranian caviar, which plays a central role in Golestan's export-led economy, with over 90% exported worldwide. Notably, one producer alone exported 3 tons of caviar in the previous year.
Our exports reach countries including Mexico and Brazil. This year, we exported 3 tons of caviar and produced 120 tons of sturgeon meat, used both domestically and for export. Our latest shipment also included 9 tons of crab.
Producers emphasize that using advanced technologies has helped improve production quality, representing a significant step toward boosting Iranian caviar exports.
To increase productivity and improve product quality, we enhance our water quality using modern equipment, including drum filters and ozone generators.
Golestan's fisheries infrastructure includes over 120 sturgeon farms, 15 breeding centers, and modern processing plants. Experts say that employing technologies such as recirculating aquaculture systems, AI, and genomics could raise annual caviar production to 200 tons and sturgeon meat output to 1,000 tons.
With premium-grade Iranian caviar gaining global demand, experts say that the right mix of private sector investment, state support, and modern aquaculture science could turn Golestan into a national model for sustainable fisheries.
Farzan Ashuryun, Gorgon.
Sunday, in major Australian cities in support of Palestinians in Gaza, the rallies took place under the name The Genocide Continues. Protesters denounced continued Israeli attacks and restrictions on aid entry into Gaza despite a ceasefire that took effect in early October. In Brisbane, about 1,000 people took to the streets, rejecting a plan proposed by US President Donald Trump to end the Gaza war.
I have family in Gaza, and they're in Jabalia, and they're completely under siege. This plan is not a plan for peace. This peace plan is a plan for further occupation and a further annexation of land that is not Israeli land.
Last week, some media revealed that Australia continued to transfer to Israel parts for the F-35 fighter jets and other materials, even on passenger aircraft, until October this year.
Last September, Australia recognized Palestine as a sovereign state, becoming one of more than 150 countries to do so. However, pro-Palestine advocates in Brisbane believe that much more is needed from the Australian government to satisfy its obligations under international law.
It's not enough, but there's also a lot more to happen there. There is recognizing that the genocide has been unfolding in the past 2 years, recognizing that there are approximately 100,000 Palestinians who have been killed. At least 83% of them are civilians and innocent people, and women and children.
More protests in solidarity with the besieged Palestinians are expected to be organized in various Australian cities before Christmas festivities. Max Civili, Brisbane.
Tunisia's anti-normalization movement is entering a new phase. Civil society groups have announced the national initiative to gather 1 million signatures to push parliament to adopt an explicit law criminalizing normalization with the Israeli regime. The campaign builds on years of public opposition reinforced by the Trump-brokered Abraham Accords, which reignited fears of regional pressure on Tunisia to follow suit.
This initiative enjoys broad popular support. Our goal is to collect 1 million signatures to criminalize normalization in Tunisia. Since the Abraham Accords, we witnessed growing public concern and we started raising awareness across the region, where we found strong and consistent backing.
But organizers say the process will take time. Signature collection has not yet begun, as activists work to establish a secure legal mechanism for protecting personal data, a major concern among supporters of the initiative.
We began distributing flyers across different governorates, and we are now working on the legal framework for handling personal data in coordination with the Personal Data Protection Authority and the Interior Ministry to ensure full protection for citizens.
Inside the parliament, the legislative path remains uncertain. Although lawmakers submitted a draft law to criminalize normalization, the process stalled after the speaker relayed that the presidency had warned such legislation could harm Tunisia's external national security.
Parliament has already submitted and voted on the draft law, but it was suspended and remains pending. I believe the 1 million signatures initiative can support and intensify public pressure to move the law forward.
As activists finalize the legal groundwork, the campaign highlights a national debate balancing public pressure, data protection, and the political sensitivity of the proposed law. As Tunisia moves toward launching its 1 million signature campaign, the key question is how public mobilization, data safeguards, and political institutions will converge to advance a law that remains both sensitive and highly contested. Iskandar Nawar, Tunisia.
It may be just a song contest, but analysts say this could be the moment that triggers long-awaited international pressure on the Israeli regime over its crimes against humanity. Because Israel will take part, Ireland will not participate in the 2026 Eurovision Song Contest next May. And state broadcaster RTE is also refusing to air the event.
This is great for to see Ireland boycotting. And I wish to see my own home country, Norway, do this exactly same thing. Where we have been discussing the same topic as you guys in terms of boycotting this year's Eurovision if Israel's going to participate.
Ireland will not be a participant in next year's Eurovision Song Contest.
The same step has been taken by public broadcasters in Spain, the Netherlands and Slovenia, generating creating widespread international coverage. Campaigners say this alone is a major victory, but they insist pressure must now intensify on EU leaders to seize the moment and impose tough sanctions on Tel Aviv.
I am ashamed to be a European at the moment, because the European Union is doing nothing at all. It's not doing nothing to stop the genocide, it's contributing to the genocide.
The European Broadcasting Union, which oversees Eurovision, moved swiftly to ban Russia, yet has taken no such action against Israel. Activists argue that if a major country like Germany were to withdraw, the message would be impossible to ignore. But they say Berlin is unlikely to act due to lingering guilt over World War II.
We are seeing a genocide, you know, in front of our eyes. So you can get away from this guilt feeling and try to solve this problem.
For its part, Irish broadcaster RTE says it would be unconscionable for Ireland to be involved in the Eurovision Song Contest, given the appalling loss of life in Gaza and the humanitarian crisis there. While the decision by RTE has been broadly welcomed here in Ireland, pressure continues on the Irish government to cut all trade ties with Israel and also use its influence in Brussels to encourage other EU countries to do the same. Jerome Hughes, Dublin.
The Trump administration has released its national security strategy for 2025, a document that marks stark differences from earlier strategies issued by the same administration. Let's go over some of the key details.
Western hemispheric dominance, aiming to block what it calls foreign influence in the Americas and shift U.S. military assets toward the Western hemisphere, away from theaters whose relative importance to American national security has declined in recent decades.
The strategy outlines a major shift in U.S. military posture. Observers say the move may be linked to recent U.S. strikes on boats in the Caribbean and the Pacific, and efforts to remove Venezuelan leader Nicolas Maduro by force.
Deterring conflict over Taiwan, unlike earlier strategies that framed China as the top geopolitical rival, the 2025 NSS declares that economic relations are the decisive arena. It underscores the need for allies, particularly India, to increase defense spending to help balance China's growing power in the Indo-Pacific.
The document signals a change in tone. Rather than framing China solely as a geopolitical rival, it emphasizes economic competition as the decisive arena. At the same time, it calls on allies, particularly India, to increase defense spending to help balance China's growing influence in the Indo-Pacific.
Berating Europe, criticizing Europe's migration policies, regulatory focus, and handling of Ukraine conflict, suggesting that the continent must take primary responsibility for its own defense. Switching focus from the West Asia, declaring the region no longer a top priority due to U.S. energy independence and perceived decline in conflict, though still committed to Israel's security. It goes on to argue that the conflict and violence in the region are also subsiding, citing the ceasefire in Gaza and the U.S. attack on Iran in June, which it said significantly degraded Tehran's nuclear program.
It declares the United States energy independent, a claim critics say underscores whether Washington's past involvement in the region was driven by oil. Yet critics point out that Israeli violations of the Gaza ceasefire continue, and Iran remains determined to pursue its peaceful nuclear program. Upon a question about Gaza ceasefire's phase two, Trump told reporters on Thursday that it was going along well. He acknowledged Palestinian deaths as a problem, yet he insisted that West Asia is at peace.
We have peace in the Middle East. People don't realize it. We have tremendous support. 59 countries. There's tremendous support.
Tehran has dismissed the strategy as essentially a security document for Israel. Iran argues that ensuring U.S. access to regional energy resources and guaranteeing Israel's security are the two fundamental issues driving Washington's policy in West Asia. Critics say the new national security strategy only underscores the hypocrisy of the Trump administration, revealing that America's true aim has always been dominating global energy and expanding Israel's power at any cost.
diverse range of programs. Youth, spirituality, culture, Eastern tales, roundtable discussions, politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
The first methodology that the Quran uses is to talk to the emotional side of the human being.
Ya ayyuhal ladheena amanu, O you who believe, ista'inu bis sabri was salah.
And we have set forth for mankind in this Quran full of examples.
Minbar, a lecture on Islamic issues.
Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
Dear audience of IRIB English Radio, Salamun Alaikum. Now it's time to listen to a short speech by Sheikh Osama Abdul Ghani.
Salamu Alaikum Jamian wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. I begin in the name of Allah, the most kind, the most merciful. It's due to that kindness and mercy that we have these opportunities where we gather in remembrance and glorification of Him, Tabaraka wa Ta'ala. I want to start today by just narrating a hadith that is reported by Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alayhi wa alihi wa sallam. Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad, where he describes the status of Zahra alayhi salam, and he says, wa amma ibnati Fatima fa innaha sayyidatu nisa'il alameen min al-awwalina wal-akhirin. That my daughter Fatima is the best of the women of the world, from the first to the last. وَهِيَ بَضَعَةٌ مِّنِّي وَهِيَ نُورُ عَيْنِي. And she is a part of me and the light of my eyes. وَهِيَ ثَمَرَةَ فُؤَادِي وَهِيَ رُوحِي أَلَّتِي بَيْنَ جَنْبَي. And she is the fruit of my heart and the spirit that resides within my body. Very beautiful. I think we've talked about this, you know, that it's important, like, you know, when we look at these statements, and it's something that I know I brought up a few years ago, like, this should never be like, ah, this is just a description of a father to a daughter, you know? I don't know how many fathers have talked about their daughters in this way, you know? But this is the messenger of God describing to us what God wants him to describe to us. That she is a part of the Prophet, meaning not from the loins or the flesh, the way we, our children, are a part of us, but rather the message that exists within the Prophet is passed through to Fatima alayhi salam. Yeah? And this is something that we should never forget, that she is that link, she is that holder of the faith and the display of that faith that the Prophet brought to teach us. And then he continues in this hadith and he says, وَهِيَ حَوْرَةٌ وَهِيَ وَهِيَ الْحَوْرَةُ الْإِنْسِيَةِ. That she is a heavenly being. مَتَى قَامَتْ فِي مِحْرَابِهَا بَيْنَ يَدَيْ رَبِّهَا جَلَّ جَلَالُهُ ظَهَرَ نُورُهَا لِمَلَائِكَةِ السَّمَاءِ كَمَا يَظْهَرُ نُورُ الْكَوَاكِبِ لِأَهْلِ الْأَرْضِ. That whenever she stands for prayers in her mihrab, in her prayer niche, she says, her light shines brightly for the angels of the heavens, the way the lights of the stars shine brightly for the people of earth. And whenever she stands for prayer, يَقُولُ اللَّهُ عَزَّ وَجَلَّ لِمَلَائِكَ. That Allah then says and boasts to the malaika, the angels, and says, يَا مَلَائِكَتِي أُنْظُرُوا إِلَىٰ أَمَتِي فَاطِمَةً. That look, he says to the angels, look at my servant Fatima. You know, this should be the goal, yeah? Our goal should be where we rise to such a degree of faith that Allah boasts about us. Allah tells the angels, look at my servant. You know, this is where true, like, all of us are the servants of God. But at the end of the day, not all of us are of the same status. There are some who strive harder. There are some who work harder. And it's these people who strive harder and work harder who truly are stars on earth. Yeah? And these stars are the one that God himself is proud of and tells angels to look at this servant of mine. And then Allah Azza wa Jal, according to the Prophet, continues and he says, Unduru ila amati Fatima. سيدتي إمائي قائمة بين يدي ترتعد فرائصها من خيفتي وقد أقبلت بقلبها على إبادتي. He says, look at how she stands in front of me. When her limbs tremble in awe of me, and she has turned her attention to my worship with all of her heart. And then the last part of this hadith says something really beautiful. But he says, Ushhidukum, God says to the angels, Ushhidukum, I want you to witness. I bear witness upon you. Anni qad amantu shi'ataha minan nar. That I have guaranteed protection from the fire of hell to her Shia. That's the part of it that is the reward, yeah, for those who can actually become her Shia. But the part prior to this, where Allah Azza wa Jal says that look at her and how her limbs shake and how her heart is attentive to me. Is this dual responsibility of servitude that I think stands out. Yeah? That servitude is not just about our external nature and how we pray to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala externally. Meaning, have I mastered my wudu? Have I mastered my ruku? Have I mastered my qira'at? This is what we teach in the madrasa. Yeah? We teach our children this from when they are young. How to perfect their external nature. But the responsibility of every single human being beyond that is to make sure that their hearts are also in tune with that external worship. And it's this dual nature when you have your internal and your external gel together that makes a person rise in iman. To that state where a person who has this dual nature gelled together, where not only am I worried about my external jurisprudential responsibilities, but I'm also worried whether or not my heart is attentive to God, whether or not my heart is mindful of God. You know, this is not easy, right? This is something, yes, you know, like I'm torn about this. I get asked this question all the time, you know, like, how do I get my kids to be in love with Salah? And, like, you know, my first question is, like, are you in love with Salah? Right? Like, how can a grown person who's not have a heart in Salah, convince their children to have their heart in Salah. It's a tough thing to do. But there's a catch-22 as well, where for a long time, if I haven't paid attention to my heart being attentive in Salah, now to break a 40, 50-year-old habit becomes very difficult. Yeah. Now you have this built upon rust in our hearts that needs to be chiseled away so that the heart becomes awake. And so we need to start them young. But I can't lose focus of the fact that I, as a grown-up and adult, also need to focus on this, right? And so maybe as a collective, we can focus on this. But the responsibility is to have, or the ultimate goal, really, is to have the inner and the external gel together. And when a person does this, they, from a label perspective, become what's known as a sadiq or a sadiqa. A person who is truthful, right? A man who is truthful is known as sadiq. A woman who is truthful is known as sadiqa. And this title of sidq is applied to that person who is truthful both externally, where now I know what I'm doing and I do it well, but they are also truthful internally, where their heart is only turned towards Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. And so that's a status that is available. And it's from this that we understand the status of Zahra, where not only was she a sadiqa, but she was a siddiqa. Yeah? Where she was the person who had attained the highest statuses of sidq. And we'll talk about the distinction between these going forward. The title of siddiqa is very important. It's a title that we are told is given to her by Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala.
The mother of Aima, Ya Fatima, the mother of Aima, Ya Fatima, you are the Sayyidatun Nisa, God made you the center of Kisa, by your name the sinners get Shifa. On that fearful day to Allah will pray, raise us with a Zahra we shall say. On that fearful day
تشويت الزهراوي شلسي
Planets look like diamonds in the sky, and everything on earth was created for you and I. Can we not see man is merely smiling at your fellow man, or looking up at the velvet sky, and sometimes it makes me wonder why we're all still here. Do we feel a deeper meaning? All again, do we think it's all again? Do we think it's all again? Do we think it's all again?
Around the computer, watch the video, and it changed our lives forever. I couldn't stop wondering why. I was screaming at the TV.
Is death not being called a homicide?
In a matter seconds you see him, you know, being killed, murdered right before our eyes.
A Staten Island grand jury has decided not to invite an NYPD officer in the death of a man on Staten Island.
These police officers in riot gear trying to hold this position at Camden and Howard. The protesters are basically right in their faces.
Protesters in Minneapolis have attempted to shut down the city's airport this afternoon. The group representing the Black Lives Matter movement blocked two roads outside the terminal before state police ordered the group to disperse.
Back to the situation in downtown Los Angeles. Looks like protesters have moved now onto the 101 freeway in downtown.
Earlier in the day, organizers of the group promised that a demonstration involving hundreds of protesters would shut down the Mall of America.
You know, I don't remember the kind of life before what's going on. Like, you know, all of my activities have to do with basically what we call the revolution. You kind of just dive in it head first. It's like, so you can't stop. And, you know, I feel like if I stop this time, I can no longer complain about anyone that's murdered unarmed after, you know, Akai Gurley and Eric Gardner and Mike Brown. So I have to keep going with this. Martin Luther King, I mean, he was in the movement for 13 years before he was assassinated. So it's not something that's going to be overnight. The significance to me of Black Lives Matter is that it's something that's nationwide. It's not just a New York problem. It's a New Jersey problem. It's across the United States. And, you know, Black Lives Matter is basically calling attention that, hey, you know, you say that all lives matter. And yes, all lives matter, but black lives aren't mattering right now. So that's what we're trying to let you guys know is, hey, you know, hi, Black Lives Matter. You know, we're being kind of hunted, and it's a little bit of a pattern. At first, you know, people could say maybe it was a coincidence, but now it's just a pattern. And it's almost like every year there's some, you know, publicly broadcasted, you know, murder of an unarmed African-American or brown person.
Well, I moved to New York in November for work. I'm an attorney. I work in banking and financial compliance. But I've always been really active outside of work in, like, activists and social justice missions. I don't think people want to confront the issue that there's an issue with our system, that our police, not all of them, but there are some within those ranks, are brutalizing and terrorizing American citizens. And so I believe in our Constitution. I do believe in our criminal justice system. I think it, you know, it has the potential to be a great system, but the corruption within it and the bias within it makes it a very dangerous system for black and brown people.
Our justice system is not corrupt. It's just very decentralized in comparison to other democratic countries. And when it's decentralized, it's based on a variety of standards for people who are part of the system. And some of the standards are not as high as we would like them to see. And then people paint with a very broad brush, extrapolating from one jurisdiction to another. Definitely we have race issues in our society, not just in the United States, in many other countries. Police officers are recruited from the society and from the community. So there's no doubt in my mind that some of the officers have various biases.
February 26, 2012, in Sanford, Florida, Trayvon Martin, an unarmed 17-year-old high school student coming home from a nearby convenience store, was fatally shot by George Zimmerman, a neighborhood watch captain. Martin died from a single gunshot wound to the chest. When police arrived at the scene, Zimmerman admitted that he shot Martin, but he claimed he had acted in self-defense. No charges were initially brought against Zimmerman. It was not until the shooting garnered national attention that Zimmerman was charged in connection with Martin's death. In July 2013, a jury acquitted Zimmerman of all charges. Upon the not guilty verdict, there were protests nationwide in more than 100 cities. President Obama said that he identified with the boy. Trayvon Martin could have been me 35 years ago.
Why was it that Trayvon tended to fizzle out? Well, one reason was because he got all of that rage that was finally manifest. But it was geared toward what? Laws, stand your ground. It wasn't geared toward the powers that be. It wasn't geared toward the federal government. It wasn't geared toward the White House. It was geared toward state laws. Well, why is that so? Well, that's exactly what the powers that be wanted it to be. See, the president's office, what did he do? He sent his own extension, who was Sharpton. And Sharpton gives a great speech, and it's all about state laws rather than police going to jail. Everybody knows that you're not going to change arbitrary police power until policemen start going to jail. Why is it that in the last 7 years you haven't had one policeman go to jail? It's the same reason why you haven't had one Wall Street executive go to jail. Because the government doesn't want them to go to jail. The government don't want to put power in that direction to go to jail. You can rest be assured, if you had a massive network of poor people engaged in gangster activity like Wall Street did with market manipulation and insider trading, those folk going to get caught and go to jail. You can rest be assured that the police were killing well-to-do white folk. Some policemen was going to jail. It's a priority. It's not a priority of the U.S. government to send policemen to jail. Not until it starts affecting them in the way it already affects many of us. And you see, some of us believe that the life of a poor black person, a poor blind person, has exactly the same value as that of a well-to-do white or well-to-do black or anybody else of the upper class.
We did have officers jailed for excessive force, and especially in we had a case, an infamous case in Charleston in South Carolina, when the officer shot an individual in his back, and he's right now in prison. The judicial system is not designed to avoid prosecution of police officers, but because the standard is a standard of discretion of the individual police officer, and the standard is based on, again, individual perceptions of the situations, it appears sometimes that there is injustice because we look at this behavior in hindsight, and for us it appears as excessive, but for the officer at the given moment on the street it wasn't excessive, and the jurors frequently accept the word of the officer.
There is growing outrage tonight after an unarmed African-American teenager was shot and killed by police in the St. Louis suburb of Ferguson, Missouri.
There was a struggle, and one of the men pushed the officer into his car.
Within the police car, there was a struggle over the officer's weapon. There was at least one shot fired within the car.
The struggle spilled out onto the street, where Brown, whom investigators say was not armed, was fatally shot.
Police have shot this man for no reason.
A little more than a year later, Michael Brown, an 18-year-old unarmed African-American man, was shot and killed in Ferguson, Missouri, a northern suburb of St. Louis. Brown, who had stolen several packages of cigarillos from a nearby convenience store shortly before the shooting, was confronted by 28-year-old Darren Wilson, a white Ferguson police officer. The disputed circumstances of the Brown shooting sparked unrest in the majority black city, and protests erupted. The events received considerable attention in the U.S. and elsewhere, and generated a vigorous debate about the relationship between law enforcement and African Americans, as well as the use of force by police in Missouri and across the nation.
In Ferguson, Michael Brown case, it's the word of the police officer, and we don't have any footage. We don't have the only footage that we have is what happened before at the convenience store. The footage at the convenience store is not very, you know, positive in terms of how I look at this. It shows somebody who is acting very aggressively within the convenience store, and it gives me an indication that there was some level of violence that was displayed.
The Black Lives Matter movement focuses primarily on the experience of black men and has shaped the conversation about police brutality, where it occurs, and how it's addressed. But black women are also being killed, assaulted, and victimized by police. Women are often targeted in the same way as men, through shootings, police stops, and racial profiling. A growing number of Black Lives Matter activists, including the women behind the original hashtag, have been refocusing attention on how African American women and other marginalized communities are treated by the police. They're not only highlighting the impact racial discrimination has on their communities, but articulating why a movement for racial justice must be inclusive. Women have been at the forefront of organizing marches, die-ins, protests, and various initiatives to have their voices heard. Young African American women have been playing a central role.
Supposed to be the judge, jury, and executioner. That's the end of the story, yeah. Really.
Like, say hypothetically one or two of these shootings are justified. They don't even give us that opportunity to think, you know, critically about it, because regardless of what happens with the situation, they're not held accountable, which is the part that bothers me the most. It's like, regardless of what's happening, if it's a little boy, unarmed, kid sleeping, a grown man, you know, selling cigarettes, no matter what the police does to them, they're not being held accountable.
And there's no data. That's another big issue that I think when we have the demands, I mean, because I like Esther's, her list of demands, they kind of just echo what everyone's kind of feeling in the movement, but there needs to be data, because why can't we find any, you know, data about how many police-involved shootings, how many fatalities, how many were armed, how many weren't armed? We need that kind of information.
That's a serious issue. I think we need to really capitalize on, like, the momentum that we have here, and definitely use that to engage the young people, because those are the people who are going to make a change. And that's why we have to do this at a local level. You know what I'm saying? We have to focus locally. And I think, like, our demonstrations, the vigil being one of them, is a good way to do that. You know what I'm saying? Just re-engage people at a local level and then help them to see that we can make change. So thank you guys, as always, for going out and supporting Erica. Night after night, I mean, we do that weekly, on a weekly basis, two nights a week. So when one of us can't get there, I appreciate that somebody is there to support her.
On July 17th, 2014, almost 1 year after George Zimmerman was acquitted in connection with the shooting death of Trayvon Martin, Eric Gardner, a 43-year-old father of six, died of a heart attack while in police custody. He was being arrested when a New York Police Department officer, Daniel Pantaleo, put Gardner in a chokehold. Gardner was arrested on a Staten Island street corner on suspicion of selling untaxed cigarettes. After Gardner resisted being arrested, Pantaleo pulled Gardner to the ground by the neck and placed him into a fatal chokehold. In a cell phone video taken by a passerby, Gardner, who suffered from chronic asthma and heart problems, repeatedly says, "I can't breathe," 11 times in total. This video has been viewed more than 2.5 million times. A grand jury declined to indict Officer Pantaleo, and he remains with the NYPD.
on July 17th, my father was out here just like another regular day, you know, talking with his friends. That day, I was at work. I worked in Long Island at that time. I got a call from my mom. I was talking to my mom. And then about 5-10 minutes after I got off the phone with my mom, my sister calls, and she's like, you know, she don't know what's going on. She's my mom is, you know, all hysterical, crying. She don't know what's going on. They just said, Dad, just stop breathing. So she started calling, you know, the hospital, trying to figure out what was going on. We couldn't get no information in from the phone. They called her and told her, you know, that it was something that went down and my dad stopped breathing. You know, she didn't know that it had anything to do with the cops until she got to the hospital. And so by the time we came to Staten Island, me, my aunt, and my cousins, you know, we drove past this part of where it happened, and we seen a whole bunch of news vans and yellow tape, and we still didn't know what was going on. So we got to my grandmother's house, and that's when a reporter from the Daily News was there, and he told us, you know, it was a confrontation with the cops, and there's a video, and would you guys like to see it before it goes out on the internet, and would you give us permission to let it go out? And me and my brothers and sisters sat around the computer, watched the video, and it changed our lives forever. I couldn't stop. Like, I couldn't stop wondering why, you know. I was screaming at the TV because, you know, in a matter of seconds, you see him, you know, being killed, murdered right before our eyes, and it was just horrible for us to see. I mean, we couldn't go into the living room and describe what we seen on the TV, on the computer, to our grandparents or to my mother, because it was so horrible. Like, I was sick that day. I mean, I just, you know, my whole body, it was just like shaky. I just couldn't believe. And then when me and my aunt was driving back to Brooklyn, we stopped over here after all the cops left and everything, and people noticed me. I never been to Staten Island like that. Like, I stayed in Brooklyn, but my father used to talk a lot about me and his granddaughter, and when they noticed my face, that I looked like my dad, you know, the love was just pouring out. You know, people was telling me their versions of the story, and it was just like, wow. I still can't believe this happened.
The Eric Garner case is problematic in the sense that experts in martial arts and some other people who specialize in takedowns of individuals believe that this was more of a takedown than a chokehold. Part of the problem is the patrol guide or operating procedures, standard operating procedures of NYPD that were very broad. They were changing now. The use of force procedures have been changed since Eric Garner case.
A recent study on children, published in the Journal of Personality and Social Psychology, found that black boys as young as 10 are more likely to be mistaken as being older, be thought of as guilty of possible crimes, and face police violence if accused of a crime. According to a ProPublica analysis of federally collected data on fatal police shootings, young black males were 21 times more likely to have been shot dead by police than their white counterparts. The 1,217 deadly police shootings from 2010 to 2012 captured in the federal data show that black males, ages 15 to 19, died at the hands of police at a rate of 31.17 per million. White males in the same age range were killed at a rate of just 1.47 per million.
Breaking news tonight. It was a case that sparked outrage across the nation and heartbreak here in Cleveland. 12-year-old Tamir Rice playing with a gun outside a rec center. The gun turned out to be fake, and he was shot to death by a rookie police officer who says that he thought it was real. Now the Cuyahoga County prosecutor has released three brand new reports on this shooting just within the past few hours. One is from the Highway Patrol. The other two are from experts asked to weigh in on this case months ago. They both found that the officer was justified. So who are these experts and how did they reach this decision?
In November 2014, 12-year-old Tamir Rice was shot and killed by a police officer in Cleveland, Ohio. Two officers, Timothy Lohman and Frank Garnbeck, were responding to a 911 call reporting that a man in a neighborhood park was walking around with what was described as probably a fake gun. Just 1.5 seconds after arriving on the scene, Officer Lohman shot and killed Rice. The boy had been playing with what was later identified as an airsoft pellet gun. A video obtained by the Northeast Ohio Media Group shows Rice's 14-year-old sister running over to her brother, being tackled and forced to the ground, handcuffed, and placed in a patrol car while her brother lay dying. The video also shows that police waited 4 minutes before providing any first aid to Rice. On June 3, 2015, the county sheriff's office released a statement saying their investigation had been completed, with their findings turned over to the county prosecutor. A grand jury later declined to indict Officer Lohman.
When we talk about law enforcement, we talk about 18,000 different police departments in the United States. Most of the departments that I'm familiar with, they don't have specific training for police officers to deal with minors and toy guns. It's mentioned during sometimes the roll call, sometimes during the basic academy, that of course there's a possibility, but again, police officers are like any other people. They fear. They have fear. They have more fear probably than an average person because they also see situations that are much more dangerous and horrific than an average person. They're not taught or trained how to control their fears.
As you know, Black Lives Matter is a multiracial movement. Because if Black Lives Matter, then all lives will matter. Because usually it's the Black lives that are the last one.
Within our own nation, the consciousness has been raised. People were preaching about colorblindness. They realized that there are race issues that are still permeate our society.
I don't want my children to experience it. You know, I don't want them to grow up being afraid or teaching them to be afraid of police.
There is just as much anger out here.
These police officers in riot gear trying to hold this position at Camden and Howard.
So we were just going over some things for the vigil. It's going to be in Nicholas Hayward Jr. Park. That's in Brooklyn. He was murdered by the police. 13-year-old murdered by the police. For like really similar circumstances, very close parallel to what was happening with what happened with Tamir Rice. So it's important for me, I think, that that place be chosen and that his story be highlighted. So to that end, I'm always trying to connect the dots so that people see, yes, this is a national issue, but this is also a local issue. So his father's going to be speaking. We'll have a prayer by Pastor Omar. Words from Mr. Hayward, and then I'll close out talking about the national epidemic of police violence against children. And this is why I wanted us to meet, so that we could talk about things that I may be overlooking. Well, for one, I've applied for a PIT permit with the Parks Department. You guys know that's always important to me, but I also wanted to get your input on that. We had issues with the permit, with the march, lots of fighting with the Parks Department and the Police Department. And so they haven't been responsive yet, so I'm wondering if we're going to encounter the same issues that we did with the 4 Mile March. The reason why I choose places of public accommodation is because we have a legal right to be there. And so, like, you know, there's nothing that they can really do about us exercising our First Amendment right within a space of public accommodation.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
Good afternoon to all our listeners. You are tuning to Iran Radio. Nice to have you with us. Here are some interesting facts about Islam. Muslim scholar Ibn al-Haytham, known as al-Hazen in Europe, who was born in 965 AD, formulated the scientific method and has been referred to as the world's first true scientist. He is also often regarded as the first theoretical physicist, making a significant contribution to the theory of light and optics. Additionally, he developed what is called celestial mechanics, which led to the eventual work of Europeans such as Copernicus, Galileo, Johannes Kepler, and Isaac Newton. We'll listen to the continuation of Iran Radio. Thank you for joining us. We start off this hour's programs with our news bulletin. That will be followed by Kids Corner. The program is all about children and child's play, a fun program specially made for children. And we round up this hour with our varied radio productions feature.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.